This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk with Valparaiso University Professor Allison Schutte about the Welcome Project and the next phase, or at least a new initiative for the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And she's going to be able to take some time off next year to be able to continue working on it. We'll also tell you, too, about a Gary resident who is sharing hope for those living with cancer through his involvement in a nationwide campaign. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked with Billy Foster about that. And we'll have a conversation to find out more from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund, a project that is funding a lot of work to help improve and enhance the waterways here in Northwest Indiana. That and more coming up on Regionally Speaking today, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
You know, Gary, perhaps you didn't know, for a long time was the largest city in America, founded in the 20th century.
My father was born in Greenwood, Mississippi. My mother was born in Pontotoc, Mississippi.
My mother from New Orleans and my father from Cotton Plant, Arkansas.
They had come up to Gary, Indiana from the deep, deep south.
From Orange, Texas.
Guthrie, Oklahoma.
All of my grandparents came over from Greece.
My parents both come from Germany.
He was a dairyman from Czechoslovakia.
There was a Polish community, there was an Italian community,
Macedonian,
there was a Hispanic community,
Lithuanian,
Croatian and Serbian,
Greek, German.
So every little area of the city had pockets of ethnicity.
It was families that had, after the war, were looking for housing.
Gary was the place to be in the 40s. You know, it had the motto, I suppose it still does, the city of the century. The streets of Gary were paved with gold. That's what they heard as immigrants. And so that's where they went. They went to Gary.
What you've heard is one part of a five-part chorus of voices of Northwest Indiana residents remarking about the history of the region. It is part of a 26-minute long chorus of voices documentary that you can find on the Welcome Project of Valparaiso University's website. It's a way to bring the listener into the next phase of the Welcome Project for its co-creator, Associate Professor of English Allison Schutte, working on and how it fits into the future of the project. I spoke with Professor Schutte about the ongoing part of the Welcome Project, what's called Flight Paths, and how she's going to be spending her semester off next year, sponsored by a Philip and Miriam Kapfer research project.
Currently, our main initiative is what we're calling Flight Paths, and it is a Northwest Indiana story collection that is designed to help capture stories of people's experience in Gary and the region, specifically around the civil rights movement of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the white flight from Gary during the 60s and 70s and 80s, and the automation of the steel mills and the growth of suburbia. We want to hear from people about if their families stayed in Gary or moved within Gary, what were the reasons for that, and if they left Gary, what were the reasons for that? And we have an NEH grant, a National Endowment for the Humanities grant, currently that is allowing us to create what they call a design document for an interactive documentary website, which is our ultimate goal. We hope that the interactive documentary website will serve at least two functions. One would be for people in the region who want to see where their own family story fits in, and hopefully then learn about people's experiences who are different from them, and have a cross-county conversation in the region about what it means to be good neighbors. What is the ongoing impact of this time in Northwest Indiana, and how do we want to respond to that today? There's still a lot of tenderness in my experience from listening to people around people leaving Gary or staying in Gary and having to think about like how things could have been if people hadn't left. So I think there's a lot of conversation in the region that still needs to happen. So we do hope that the interactive documentary website will lead to that. But also nationally, we hope that it will be a platform for educators and people in other Rust Belt cities who see their experience reflected in that, or want to be able to teach their students about this feature of American history, because Gary, while it has some particular elements, is also quite representative of a larger American story. Specific website that would have an interactive map of Gary's neighborhoods and the region in which we could quote-unquote, pin the individual stories that we collect within the historical narrative. So we want to be able to tell the region's story, which is oftentimes broader and underlying individual family stories, so that those can begin to speak to each other and inform each other.
Now, since you'll have this semester off here to be able to work on this, thanks to the research award, do you think that you'll be able to get everything done that you want to on this initiative before it's time to go back to the full-time job working at the
It's not going to be that fast. This is at least a 5 to 7 year project. So my semester will give me a time to focus on specific interviews that we haven't been able to do yet. There's quite a few neighborhoods that we have not interviewed anyone from. And it will also give me a chance to think about how we present some of the historical underlying narrative on the website. So I have some research to do there, and I have some historians to interview.
Talk about, if you will, about what the CAPFR Research Award is all about.
A university research award that is specifically for people in the humanities, and it will allow the person who receives it to have either a semester off from teaching, or you could take a full year at half teaching load, and you get a stipend with it as well to help you in your research. So I'm going to be taking a semester off.
Professor Allison Schutte says they already have several Gary neighborhoods represented in Flight Paths, and you can see and hear them for now at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. All of the signs are pointing to the region's economy growing in 2018, and Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack was on Regionally Speaking to talk about what is called the Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index. He says that latest index shows that the local economy will grow by 2% in 2018, more than it has this year, but he says it's still slower growth historically than elsewhere in Indiana.
When you look a little bit deeper, while this growth is positive, it's much slower than you see both at the state and the nation. So while we've been averaging about 1.2% per year over the last 10 years, mm-hmm. the state has averaged 2.9%, and the United States has averaged 2.9%. So we're growing a little bit slower than the state and the nation. Part of the reason is when you look at what is growing in Northwest Indiana, the types of jobs and the types of income that people are getting, there's a big split between goods-producing jobs that we, our traditional manufacturing, construction, things like that, and service-providing jobs, which maybe retail sales and food service. We're seeing a lot of new jobs in food service and retail sales replace older jobs that are in manufacturing. And those two types of jobs are not really equivalent. One tends to pay a lot more and have a lot better benefits than the other.
I know that you had a chance to talk in more detail about the index, or at least the latest report, here not long ago when Chancellor Lowe was holding his Commission for Community Engagement program over at IU Northwest. Was there anything in particular that you brought out in that conversation at that event that you were kind of touching on, or were you able to go into more detail with this group about?
So in that presentation, we focused a little bit more on the technical details, kind of the methodology behind the index. But kind of the one takeaway that I thought was kind of surprising was that if you go back from 2012 to 2017, the number of jobs in Northwest Indiana has basically stayed stable. We've grown a little bit, but it's only a couple hundred jobs. But if you kind of look at where those jobs are being created, we've lost about 6,000 goods-producing jobs, manufacturing jobs, and those have been replaced by about 6,000 new service-providing jobs, so retail, food service, things like that. And as I mentioned, the average wage in a retail service-providing job is roughly half what you would get if you were looking at a goods-producing job.
Well, that was probably some of the best service industry jobs, I would imagine, because I know that you had in the information that the lost manufacturing jobs, some had wages as high as $80,000. So we're probably talking about some of the jobs, the best jobs at the steel mills. And then you take that, and if you take that in half, it's not quite $40,000. That still has to be a pretty well-paying job in the service sector to make that much, I would think.
That's true. And so we're seeing a lot of jobs also in healthcare, which has been kind of a big boon for the region. Nationally, service-providing jobs pay a lot more than Northwest Indiana because we haven't really kind of focused too much on service-providing jobs here. We're our history, our lifeblood is in manufacturing. We tend to think about it in that way. But the types of jobs nationally that pay well in our service providing, things like accounting, finance, computer systems, consulting, management, we haven't really given too much attention to here in Northwest Indiana. Yeah. And I think, you know, for the future, that's what we need to focus on. Replacing manufacturing jobs one at a time isn't going to kind of provide a long-term solution to our economy. We need to think more about how can we bring in those service providing jobs that pay $80,000 or $90,000, and how do we bring those to the region?
In the past, I know we have talked about, and I'm sure it hasn't changed since the last time we talked about this, was, and you mentioned here about the fact that we need to look for higher paying jobs. And I imagine a lot of this too has to fit into, we have to retain our college graduates here in Northwest Indiana. Once they graduate from IU and Purdue and all the other schools around Northwest Indiana, we have to keep them here at home if they're living here, so that they are able to be productive parts of the workforce.
Yeah, absolutely. In order to attract these types of jobs, we need to have the type of workforce that firms are looking for. And so we need to look at, why are people leaving and what can we do to keep them here? And often it's a question of quality of life. What services and amenities can we provide here in Northwest Indiana that we haven't been in a while? You know, we have to compete directly with Chicago many times, unfortunately. And so that can be tough to do. You know, Chicago has a lot of different amenities that may be appealing to younger people and to millennials. And so when they finish their degree, they may decide to move to Chicago to pursue a career and change their living environment. And so how do we create an environment here in Northwest Indiana that is, you know, a place that somebody wants to live and somebody wants to raise their kids in?
I know that, speaking of the Chicago area being a competitor, certainly for jobs and for the quality of life that we want here in Northwest Indiana, but now we have this other issue that's just come up recently, is the interest that Amazon has wanting to find a location for its second world headquarters. And we know that Chicago's in the running. We know the city of Gary, Indiana's in the running, as Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson has gone out and done her best to try to get the attention of Jeff Bezos in out on the West Coast, telling him, hey, you should locate your HQ2 in Gary, Indiana. So we're fighting at it. We're working on it, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this push to try to attract something like Amazon, again, actually attracting Amazon is going to be kind of a long shot, but to attract something like this has really opened the eyes of a lot of people, I think, because, like I said, up until now, we've always focused on how do we bring in another manufacturing or plant or manufacturing firm. And now, when you realize that you have these high-paying service sector jobs that you could potentially be attracting here, what do we need to do to kind of lay the groundwork and make this an environment where these jobs are more likely to come in?
Nina, I've talked with other people and asked them the question, so I'll pose the question to you. Do you think that Northwest Indiana stands a chance at least, if not getting the second headquarters, at least getting some economic benefit out of it, wherever it may happen to go? At least here in the Midwest, certainly.
Yeah, certainly if he goes to Chicago, we will get benefit. There are quite a few people that live in Northwest Indiana and work in Chicago, so that will be certainly helpful. But whether it's Amazon or it's the headquarters of some other major company, this is the type of thing we need to look for and try to encourage in Northwest Indiana, because this is what's growing nationally and the types of jobs that are high-paying and desirable. And so those are the ones we need to bring in here and focus on.
Northwest Indiana economist Micah Pollack also says that it's time for governmental and political leaders to set aside their territorial tendencies, come up with a unified economic plan for Northwest Indiana. A Gary resident is a sharing hope for those living with cancer, and through his involvement in a nationwide campaign, Billy Foster was featured on the Jumbotron in Times Square back in October. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke with Foster about the experience and about the message behind it.
Tell me about your involvement with the cancer awareness campaign. And by the way, I'm sorry about your situation.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, the program is called This is Living with Cancer. And there are several of us. I think there are 8 altogether. And what they did was come by and film us and talk to us about our particular stories as far as our journeys with cancer. And you can find it online at thisislivingwithcancer.com. It's something that was sponsored by the Pfizer company.
Now, how did they find you to participate in the ad?
Well, the way that I was found was they interviewed over 100 people, I'm told, but I was recommended by someone I know at the Kidney Cancer Association.
Is that the kind of cancer you have, kidney cancer?
It is. I have renal cell carcinoma metastasized to my lungs and liver and originally in my brain, but we were able to laser that away. So I still have the other, though.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. So did you grow up in Gary?
I did.
So what is the ad about?
Well, what it's about is it's about these different stories, and the idea is to for people who are have a cancer diagnosis to watch the stories and see that you can live with cancer and do pretty well. They're inspirational stories, and that's what it's about. They also developed an app that you can put, like, your doctor's numbers and your diagnosis and a whole lot of other things that you can keep on your phone. The app is called Living With. You can keep in touch with other patients through the app or people that you want to keep in contact with and keep appraised of your situation.
How have you been doing? Have you been living well with cancer?
Yeah, actually, it's a whole story. I originally had my kidney taken out in 1996, which had a cancerous tumor, and then from there until 2007, I was okay. But in 2007, we found that we had this renal cell carcinoma metastasis to my lungs, liver, and brain. But I was able to get into a clinical trial that kept everything stable until 2013, and now I'm on a medication. Like, kidney cancer is one of the cancers you can't really get rid of unless you can just remove the whole kidney. But the metastasis, you have to, the best thing is to be able to keep it stable, and we've been able to do that with mine.
One more thing. What did you get out of being involved in the campaign?
Well, two things. I think it's my thing is I've been blessed to be saved and to be here, and so I think what I'm here for is to help other people that are in the same situation. And by doing that, it also helps me.
Good luck to you.
Well, thanks much.
On Saturday, December 9th, members of fire stations and fire departments all across Northwest Indiana will be meeting in Valparaiso for their very first ever Fire Service Leadership Seminar. It's an event to be held at MAC, which is short for the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative. And we asked the Portage Fire Chief Tom Pfeiffer to explain the organization and how important this particular event coming up will be to the communities that these firefighters are serving.
The MAC, which is the most advanced public safety, whether it be fire, EMS, or police training center, probably in Northwest Indiana, probably the best in Indiana. Other people would probably dispute that a little bit, but for us, I would say the best, you know, as a guy who's helping put all this together, the best in Indiana. But the MAC's, the whole idea of the MAC is to give local emergency responders the best place to train, whether it be in a classroom or hands-on, actually doing the skills it takes to do your job. The whole goal there is just to make sure that we have the best facilities to train our people to the fullest advantage that we can give them.
And I know that the organization's had a number of seminars and other training sessions. Is this being the very first time they've actually decided to create a fire service leadership seminar?
Yeah, so this will be our first one. So the MAC officially has only been open about 2 months. Now, we've been, you know, there's been a lot of training out there throughout the summer, but the facility itself has really been open for about the last 2 months. And, you know, when we started the process of getting the facility open, we wanted to come in with a bang, kind of, and make sure that we had, a really good leadership seminar to get people familiar with the MAC and familiar with the type of education they can get when they go to classes at the MAC.
Take a moment, if you will, and describe what the facility is like there in Valparaiso.
Facility is classrooms, your typical classroom orientation setup. You can sit and have lecture halls and do the things that you would think of a traditional classroom. But the facility also has a four-story training building, a live burn building that we can run, practice residential and commercial building fires in. The four-story building can, you know, we can do search and rescue. We can, police departments can use canine training or SWAT team training. So the buildings are set up to be multifunctional, hands-on, and can be set up so where either a firefighter can, you know, go and do firefighter duties or a police officer can go in and, run different police duties, of clearing rooms and, making entry and the things that they need to do for the you know, their more tactical side of police work.
Okay. Is this the type of building that fire departments, when they hire recruits and put them on the force, they put them through, obviously, training first so they know what to do when they're actually on the job and the alarm goes off, so they get to learn more about firefighting skills and techniques, and the opportunity comes up for them to learn their skills there at MAC, and maybe to supplement or to go along with whatever they might happen to get at their home fire department?
Yeah, so, and currently at the MAC right now, the state's divided into 10 districts, but for the Homeland Security, we are District 1, and the District 1 Career Fire Academy is going on at the MAC right now. It's a 9-week, all-inclusive firefighting from raising ladders to spraying hoses to putting out fires to auto extrication, just about everything that you can think of that a firefighter would need to do, they're getting packed into that 9 weeks. And they're out there now, and that class is going to be finishing up here the 17th of November. So, you know, as we talk about this is the entry level, brand new firefighters, right, who, you know, you walk in day one, you've seen a fire truck, and they'll walk out knowing, you know, how to operate it. So the most basic class we can do is going on in there now, and then the next level class, the leadership for chief officers and company officers, then we're going to have that class out there also. So, you know, the range of the types of classes that we can have are it's humongous. It's just the whole spectrum.
Now, for this fire service leadership seminar, you've had an opportunity to bring some experts in, literally, in what they know about dealing with emergencies, fire in particular.
This is the best lineup of speakers that we could have under one roof. These are the rock stars of the fire department. If you're a firefighter, these are names that you know. These are people who care about fire service and who are moving fire service in the next generation and who are teaching young firefighters how, you know, it's going to look 10, 20 years from now. So we're bringing in, we have five speakers coming in, and they will all give, just a little bit different perspective on, you know, different aspects of, you know, of the fire service and, you know, where we're headed. And the idea is you know, if you're a leader in the fire service, if you're a chief officer or a company officer, to just get in there and get some insight and have good conversation about, what's going to impact the fire departments over the next 10 years.
Now, you talk about having this very first fire service leadership seminar. Are there any other programs that MAC is going to be sponsoring in conjunction with the other fire departments here in Northwest Indiana to continue on the training and the education that they need?
There are always classes going on at the MAC, and you know, this is like the very first leadership one that we're putting on, but there's always a class, whether it be pump operations or the basic fire academy, there's always a class going on at MAC. Even a local, if you're the local, your local fire department can get time assigned at the MAC to go and do some of the things, you can't burn every day in your local, here in Portage, I don't have a place to set fires, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we can carve out some time at the MAC and our firefighters can go there and train to actually put out the fires and, the building's designed to do that in. So that way they can come back to the city and have actually done and be prepared for the things that we need to do.
We've been talking with Portage Fire Department Chief Tom Pfeiffer about the program, which is Northwest Indiana's first fire service leadership seminar, and just the first of many that are coming out of this organization, which is known as MAC, which, by the way, stands for the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, an opportunity for firefighters and the departments here in Northwest Indiana to get together and coordinate their training and their education processes. Chief Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us to talk about the event, and also good luck to everybody that does their continued training at MAC. There's a public-private partnership that includes representatives from our next guest who are working on offering projects some funding to help improve the habitat, stormwater management, and green space here in Northwest Indiana and all of the Calumet region. The organization is called the Chi Cal Rivers Fund, and the representatives of the contributors to this particular fund include ArcelorMittal. And we have with us Marcy Tweet, who is the head of corporate responsibility for ArcelorMittal Americas, on the line from her office. Marcy, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks, Chris. I'm excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, if you will, tell us a little bit about what the Chi Cal Rivers Fund is all about. We mentioned it's a public-private partnership. Tell us who some of the other partners are that help contribute to be able to put these projects together.
Sure. The Chi Cal Rivers Fund is a public-private partnership, like you said, and what that means is it brings together partners from the public government sector, from the private sector in business, and from foundations around the Calumet region. So on the business side, ArcelorMittal is really proud to be a part of the partnership. It also includes our friends at BNSF. And then on the foundation side, the Chicago Community Trust, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Joyce Foundation. And on the public side, U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the entire program is administered by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. So it really brings a lot of folks to the table who have different goals, different thoughts, different expertises in the field of conservation, both for land and water in the Calumet region.
How long has the fund been in operation?
The fund has been in operation for 5 years. That was actually our fifth year of granting, which was very exciting. We put $960,000 worth of grants on the ground in the Calumet this year, and we ask all of our grantees to have a match. So the total conservation impact for 2017 is $2.4 million. So a lot of great things happening with restoration, habitat improvement in this region.
When you talk about the Northwest Indiana projects in particular, go through the list and tell us what projects are being supported by this latest round of grants.
Sure. So this latest round of grants, we continued our investment in enhancing habitat and public access through the east branch of the Little Calumet River through a grant with the Save the Dunes Conservation Fund that also involves Shirley Hines Land Trust. Mm-hmm. This work of the Little Cal has gone back to the Bicentennial Nature Trust in Northwest Indiana, declaring the Little Calumet River an area of interest and an area of investment for Northwest Indiana. So not just this year with a grant amount of $570,000, but the past 2 years with very large grants in that Little Cal region, Save the Dunes, Shirley Hines, and the partners that they work with have been able to put millions of dollars of habitat enhancement on the ground in that Little Cal area to make sure that there's a lot of public access happening on the East Branch, that there's restoration happening on the West Branch, and restoring hundreds and hundreds of acres in that area.
I know there's been a lot of work in recent years by organizations, public and private, to help make it more affordable and certainly more enjoyable to get your canoe out there, or if you're into going out just on a flat boat, enjoying the river itself. And of course, a lot of that had to be cleaned up too. There was a lot of problems, I know, in many sections of the Little Calumet River. That work has been done, and it's continuing to be done. But this has to be a good way to help encourage people to enjoy the nature that's out there and that stretch of the Little Cal.
It does. We want as many Northwest Indiana residents to be able to get out and enjoy the forests, the trees, the rivers, the lake that they have in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And for ArcelorMittal, it's really important for us to invest in conservation in Northwest Indiana. Historically, the steel industry hasn't always been known as a great actor when it comes to environmental conservation. And we've been really focused these past 10 years on ensuring that we're looking at the history of the steel industry in Northwest Indiana and sort of helping to make that history cleaner, and then really focusing on the future of how we can be a trusted user of air, land, and water so that our Calumet and Northwest Indiana residents know they can trust ArcelorMittal to do what's right in the world of the environment and to make sure that our environmental nonprofits have the resources they need to make these kinds of restoration projects happen.
Now, I know that you say that the ArcelorMittal has been involved for about the last decade or so, maybe before your time working with the company. But I'm sure that you've had a chance to look back into the files and see about some of these other projects. Can you give us an idea in recent years how the fund has been able to help projects in Northwest Indiana as far as ArcelorMittal is concerned?
Absolutely. So Chi Cal Rivers Fund is one of the two major funds we work with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation on. The other major fund that I know a lot of people have heard of is Sustain Our Great Lakes. through both of those programs, we've worked not just in the Little Cal, but in the National Park, putting funds on the ground to ensure that restoration happens there. We've had great grants happening with Shirley Hines Land Trust in Miller Woods. And there's been lots of different things happening on the ground in Northwest Indiana for the past few years. We've focused on the Little Cal because it feels like it's the right place to get a lot of work done in these last couple of years. But really, we're working with Shirley Hines, with Dunes Environmental Learning Center, with Save the Dunes, with lots of different organizations, the Nature Conservancy, on answering their call to where are the most important places in Indiana for them to invest and to make sure they have the resources to do that.
And I know, too, at least over the years, folks at ArcelorMittal have been very concerned and have done what they can through the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund to help support cleanup efforts in Wolf Lake. Wolf Lake is another great organization, an opportunity to see how an organization with the Association for the Wolf Lake Initiative has been able to not only keep the lake clean, but keep the habitat almost pristine in that area. It's amazing the wildlife that is in that particular area that's just hundreds of feet from a very busy highway.
It is. I always find it so gratifying to drive across Wolf Lake and in that area when I'm traveling to and from Northwest Indiana, because I'm a Chicagoan, but love coming down there all the time. And the work that they've been able to do with those native prairies and improving public access in Wolf Lake has just been incredible over the last few years. And it's really a credit not only to the nonprofits like Illinois Conservation Foundation and great work down there, but to the residents who have said, we want to use this site. And you see it being used, boating in the summer and people on the trails around there. The quality of that habitat and public access is just incredible.
We've kind of talked about the Northwest Indiana projects that ArcelorMittal Americas has been supporting through the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund. But if you want to kind of broaden the scope and take a look at some of these other projects that pretty much incorporate the entire Chicago and Northwest Indiana area, what's gotten funded in this latest round of grants?
Sure. So one of my favorite projects we've been working with Chi-Cal Rivers Fund is with an organization called Healthy Schools Campaign that actually is a partnership in their own right, bringing together folks from open lands, from Chicago public schools, to answer the question, how do we green public school system areas? So the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund, one of our main areas of focus is green stormwater infrastructure. So looking at those impervious surfaces like parking lots and old playgrounds that maybe aren't getting a lot of great use right now, and how can we make them twofold? One, really great for the environment and helping to manage stormwater in the city of Chicago. But then second, how can they be a really catalytic opportunity for young people in Chicago to play and be outside? So it's been a great partnership, Healthy Schools Campaign, between Chicago Public Schools and these conservation associations. One of the great stories we tell is they were opening one of these playgrounds that you'd never know if you looked at it. You'd never know that it was a green stormwater project, because a lot of the sort of infrastructure of that conservation infrastructure is behind the scenes. Beautiful new playground at a Southside Chicago school. And my favorite moment that I was talking to someone about recently is they were trying to keep the kids off the playground so they could take pictures of it. And they physically couldn't hold these kids back till the ribbon was cut. So not only are these kids in a lot of these Chicago public schools that have healthy schools campaign playgrounds having more safe places to play in their neighborhoods, they're also learning about conservation through things like on-site gardens, and they're learning about cooking by harvesting their gardens and making salsa. So it really brings together health and wellness for kids, as well as green stormwater infrastructure that helps our neighborhoods. So that's a program that's been really thriving in Chicago, and I hope will continue to expand into other cities and perhaps even cross the border soon.
I was going to ask you if this project in particular with the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund has been an incentive maybe for other communities that of which ArcelorMittal America is involved in helping do some greening projects in those particular areas too.
It absolutely has. I spent some time this year out in Detroit and in Cleveland, where we have offices and facilities, talking to people there about the kinds of work we're doing in Northwest Indiana and Illinois, and bringing some of those project ideas to those folks. Healthy Schools Campaign is a really easy one that, we've seen green stormwater infrastructure work in Chicago public schools. We believe it can work in other large school systems and in small school systems all over the country. So I think these kinds of stories will continue to get out there and to help the green stormwater infrastructure community and the conservation community all over the country find those benchmark projects that'll get us all to the next level.
Now, we only had a handful of projects that got grants for this time around. How many organizations have put in requests for the grant funding through the fund, and how many more probably are kind of waiting for their share of the money in future years at least?
Sure. It varies from year to year how many applications we see. Certainly for Sustain Our Great Lakes, from in the full Great Lakes regions, we're seeing over 100 applications. We're seeing close to 50 applications a lot of years for Chi-Cal Rivers Fund. So the competition for grant money is steep. But I have to give kudos to National Fish and Wildlife Foundation on their management of this program. The program managers at National Fish and Wildlife Foundation are more than happy to get on the phone with local groups throughout the year to help them workshop these grant applications and figure out what are those things that we really want to fund, that we're really excited about. We regularly do webinars and phone calls for potential grantees, and it's been really exciting to see some of the grantees who maybe have applied 2 or 3 years ago and didn't get funded, getting funding in a couple of years because they've really been able to hone their programming, develop their expertise, and build their program so that they're ready for this level of funding. Generally, we're funding things in, over $100,000, certainly in Chi-Cal Rivers Fund with Sustain Our Great Lakes, sometimes up towards $1 million. So in order to be ready to take that kind of funding and get these kinds of big catalytic projects done, we work with those nonprofits to make sure they have the capacity to move those projects forward.
Well, it sounds like if you're talking about a project that big that would be asking for so much money, they've got to have everything all lined up. They definitely have to have their share of the business plans all ready to go so they can show everybody involved in the fund that they mean business, that they're serious about what they want to do, and they have the wherewithal to be able to get these projects off and running if they haven't gotten started already, I would imagine.
Absolutely. We ask all of our grantees to come to the table with some matched funds. So we not only want to know that they know what they're doing, we want to know that the community around them and funders that already support them are also putting their skin in the game on this, so that we've got partnerships of organizations and funders and people working together to get these things done and to make sure that they succeed long term. One of the biggest pitfalls in conservation funding is doing a great project and then finding out 5 years later that perhaps it didn't get monitored correctly, or they didn't have the volunteer support to continue to do the kind of invasive species work that needs to be done every single year. So we're really proud to work with these groups of partners that bring together a lot of folks to the table to make these things happen.
Now, Marcy, how many other organizations have gotten their bids in so far so that it's time for the next round to come out here? Any idea who's in line now coming up when the next round?
We just announced the 2017 grants. Yep. So the 2018 grant cycle will begin early in 2018. So anyone who's interested in applying for funds through the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund can go on the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation website at nfwf.org/Chi-Cal, Chi-Cal. There will be information there about the RFP process. Generally, that happens in sort of the springtime. So, for instance, this year we did a webinar in May, and the proposal narratives were due in May as well. So that's the timing for next year's grant. So people have more than enough time now to start thinking about this, to get in touch with National Fish and Wildlife Foundation or with someone at ArcelorMittal to learn more.
Well, Marcy, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. And congratulations to all of the participants and those who had received the grants here in Northwest Indiana. And looking forward to seeing a lot more improvement and some great green space across Northwest Indiana, and in particular on the Calumet River, continue to blossom. We thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate you having me on, and ArcelorMittal thanks you as well.
Marcy Tweed is the head of corporate responsibility for ArcelorMittal Americas, one of the partners in the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund. By the way, the other partners in the effort as well include the BNSF Railway, the Chicago Community Trust, the Crown Family, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Celebrate the holidays symphony style as the Northwest Indiana Symphony presents the annual Holiday Pops concert program on Thursday, December 7th at 7:30 in the evening. It'll be at the Star Plaza Theater in Merrillville. Concert's going to feature a guest vocalist, Jesse Donner, the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra Chorus, which is directed by Nancy Menk, the Hobart String Orchestra, and the Crown Point High School School Chorale. I had a chance recently to talk with the musical director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, Kirk Muspratt, about this event, which will truly be a memorable Holiday Pops concert coming up.
It is the very last time the orchestra and the chorus will ever have a performance in the Star Theater. A few weeks later, it will be torn down. So it is very bittersweet. Last year, we sold the concert out. The year before, we almost sold it out. So, you know, I'm sure it was going to sell out again. And I hope you'll all join us for this beautiful night, December 7th.
Well, tell us about the great music and the great entertainment that the folks are going to experience going to that concert.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to. You know, it's a Holiday Pops concert, so we want to have fun. We want to have sacred music. We want to have traditions. You know, if you start the program with Merry Christmas of John Williams, you certainly maybe then want to put Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer on the program with the Crown Point High School. We have a piece of really sacred music called Mother of God by the English composer John Tavener. But we also have little Julian Solis, who's 11 years old, going to sing I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas.
That'll be great.
You know, yeah.
That'll be wonderful. When you line up, especially for this particular concert, because it is so important, when you line up some of the entertainment for it, and you talk, you say about the traditional songs, not only mm-hmm. the pop songs, but the religious songs as well, too, since it's a very, very important and very sacred time of the year. Mm-hmm. When you get these ideas together, are you, as always, taking advantage of what patrons and visitors to the concerts pass along to you that they'd like to hear in maybe future concerts? And especially this such an important concert as this particular Holiday Pops concert.
Yeah, I always do. I take, last night I was coming home from another rehearsal with another orchestra, and somebody in the chorus had sent me, when I got home at 1 in the morning, there was somebody from the chorus had written to me, what about this piece for the future for blah, 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 blah. So, of course, I put that in a file, and it's editing it down. And after the concert, I always go out and talk to people, and I ask them what they like the best. And I start listening, and when you start to hear, well, I like this the best. My favorite part was the sing-along. My favorite part was the sing-along. My favorite part was the sing-along. Then you do that.
That or gives if you
hear,
clue, doesn't
or
it,
if you
guess,
hear,
yeah.
Why didn't you do Nutcracker? Why didn't you do Nutcracker?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do Nutcracker?
If you hear it more than 4 or 5 times,
yeah,
you know you better put it in
yeah,
the concert.
And you hear it from a person who's 80 years old, and you hear it from a couple that's 26 with their little 5-year-old, and so you do. This year, I tried to program a couple pieces also just to say goodbye to the star. You know, and we have a wonderful tenor from the Lyric Ryan Opera Program, Jesse Donner, who is just this magnificent, magnificent singer. He's going to be there. And of course, you know, Santa has agreed to come.
Well, of course, you know, he wouldn't miss this for the world.
No, he has to be there. There are a lot of 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds coming with mom and dad or grandma and grandpa, and we want to make sure that they see Santa there and remember him at the concert.
Well, you know for sure that there'll be a great standing ovation at the very end when the concert closes out, knowing that it'll be the last time that folks will have a chance to stand up and applaud for the symphony orchestra and all of the organizational groups coming in to perform on that Holiday Pops concert coming up.
I certainly hope so. Please join us. It's beautiful and... it's really like a big family of people when we're together in that concert.
And definitely be the case that night because it'll be such an important night for everybody.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
And be sure to bring a donation of any non-perishable food item to the concert to benefit the Northwest Indiana Food Bank. And you can go to the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra website for more information and to order tickets. But hurry, because they're going fast. If you've lived in Indiana very long, you've probably had a slice of sugar cream pie. It's often referred to as the unofficial state pie because it's so popular. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier takes us to an Eastern Indiana family-owned business that helped introduce the recipe to the masses, and she delves into how that pie became so popular in the first place.
Mike Wickersham walks out onto the production floor at the Wick's Pie Factory in Winchester. He's wearing a hairnet and yelling to try and talk over the loud equipment that surrounds us.
What I'm going to show you today is the making of a sugar cream pie, and a good pie starts with a good crust.
Mike knows a little something about a good crust. He's the president of Wick's Pies and the son of its founder. He walks us through the factory, showing us how machines and people work together to emulate the taste and consistency of a homemade crust. giant versions of the electric mixers you'd find in a home kitchen, stir together lard, flour, and water to create the dough.
And what these machines are doing, they're emulating what you would do at home on top of your counter. Their fingers moving that dough around.
Wix cranks out tens of thousands of pies and pie shells in just one eight-hour shift. These weeks leading up to Thanksgiving are its busiest of the year. And the pie that's in highest demand? Mike says it's no contest.
About 75% of what we sell is sugar cream pie.
The famous Wix sugar cream pie dates back to 1944, when Mike's father, Dwayne Wickersham, started his first restaurant in Randolph County. He couldn't find a good pie to serve, so he started baking his own. Many of the recipes he used were his grandmother's, and they became so popular, Dwayne started selling them to other restaurants.
In the 40s, he was making about 20 pies a day. In the late 50s, he was up to 200. And then in 1962, he moved into this facility, put a patent on the old-fashioned sugar cream pie, and we now make around 10,000 pies a day when we do make pies in an eight-hour shift.
Wix pies are now available in almost every region of the country, and they're common at Hoosier holiday gatherings. But sugar cream pie was popular long before Wix started mass producing it. Kate Scott works in reference services at the Indiana Historical Society. She often hears from Hoosiers who are looking for the original recipe for sugar cream pie.
So the earliest recipe that I know of is an Indiana recipe from 1816, which is the year that the state was founded, that Indiana became a state. I wouldn't be surprised if Shaker or Amish communities who traveled west to settle in Indiana were making some version of this before they came here.
Sugar cream pie gained early popularity because it's what's known as a desperation pie. You could make it year-round because it doesn't require fresh fruit. Scott says the few ingredients it needs were things most people already had in their pantries.
The only really, really consistent ingredient in sugar cream pie is sugar. In addition to sugar, though, there is usually milk or cream or half and half. It depends. You get vanilla, nutmeg, usually butter and salt, and sometimes flour and cornstarch, or one or the other, to use as a thickening agent.
It's such a celebrated part of the state's food culture. There's even a special culinary trail dedicated to Indiana pie. Mrs. Wick's Pies is one of the stops on the pie trail. Dwayne Wickersham opened the restaurant across the street from the Wick's Pie Factory when he retired in 1986. It's part of the legacy his children, including Mike, are carrying on.
Anybody of his age that grew up on a farm in rural Indiana, their mother or grandmother had a sugar cream pie recipe that she made. But he commercialized it and brought it to the consumer in the supermarket, and that opened it up for a whole new generation. And we're trying to maintain that, to continue to open that to a new generation.
And Mike is doing his part. Every day Wix is baking pies. He has at least one slice. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
A bill that was proposed back in 2009 would have made the sugar cream pie Indiana's official state pie, but the bill never made it to the governor's desk. And now it's time for Eye on the Arts with John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is my colleague, Bridget Earnshaw from South Shore Arts. Bridget is our director of exhibits, and we have just recently opened our annual Blockbuster exhibit.
Yes.
And this is for the love of the game this year. So, Bridget, the sports exhibit, how did that come about?
The sports exhibit came about... It's been at least a year and a half in the making, I feel like. And we had a man in the community named Terry McMahon, and he has a very large collection of sports memorabilia and art. And it came about that he was interested in exhibiting it, and we've kind of just ran with it and added to it. And now we have even a larger collection of sports memorabilia, and we found a few other artists to go with it. So it's a fun show with a whole bunch of different sports featured in it. We have primarily baseball, mm-hmm. going back to the early 1900s, even late 1800s. There's some photographs and some very interesting like sports action shots of the very first few games. And then going all the way to current sports, and we have some hockey and football and basketball and even a little bit of horse racing.
So, Terry's, but predominantly the exhibit features Terry McMahon's collection.
Yes.
Which is vast. And that was so neat of him to want to share it with us at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts. Terry's business, McMahon Accounting, is in Munster. And so we know him well.
Yes.
Through various associations over the years. And it's really fun to be able to showcase a local collector's property. And so we've augmented it with, well, talk about some of the arts.
Yeah.
What does Terry have?
Well, with Terry's collection of sports memorabilia, he's got quite a few Leroy Neiman prints that are really fantastic works that he's got. And Leroy Neiman was an artist, I think predominantly in like the 80s.
Mm-hmm. He was very prolific in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And he made... I don't mean to hijack what you were saying, but he did make one, if not the largest, gift by an individual to the School of the Art Institute. Oh. Yeah, not long ago.
Yeah, they're very colorful and fun. And he's got four different baseball players, including like Babe Ruth and Willie Mays. And then he's got a few horse racing ones. And then another one of our featured artists is... Mark McMahon.
I know.
No relation to Terry.
No relation whatsoever.
But he's a really interesting man. When I got to go pick up the work from him, he had, he's just got such an array of work. He's got a gallery in like Lake Forest area. Mm-hmm. And
that's where he's from.
Yeah. And I didn't know how much he has done in the, you know, community for all, and artwork that he's done for different ballparks and stadiums across, I mean, the U.S., like, all over the place. He's got work hanging, or he's done work for certain games or special things. He's been in Sports Illustrated. Mm-hmm. So just all sorts of fun stuff.
He's an artist. His work is kind of similar to Leroy Neiman's, I would say, in style. He is an artist who is who has coupled his artistic skills with his business skills very successfully.
Very.
Yeah, and we've shown him before, his work before, years ago, I remember, because there are Mark McMahon's in the... NIPSCO collection.
He's got a very large mural in NIPSCO of Indiana sports, and we have a poster of that too.
Yeah.
But his work is really fun and playful, and he's from a whole family of artists too, so it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Father, son, I know. Yeah, and others. What's your favorite piece in the show?
My favorite piece in the show, probably just because I've been researching it a lot, is this picture of... It's actually a collection of photos from an All-Star game in the 1933 All-Star players. And just reading about the All-Star game, it happened at Comiskey, which is now the, you know, Sox Stadium, but it was for the World's Fair, and it was kind of this way of getting a little bit of enthusiasm for after, like, the Great Depression era and whatnot. So, but just listening to the game and kind of seeing that whole era of when baseball was just such a exciting kind of thing, and everybody listened to it, but especially the All-Stars, because you got, you know, players that were in it, like Babe Ruth and Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, all of them were playing in this one game, and it's kind of this era that was really cool in baseball, and there's a ton of stuff that Terry has about that, but he's got portraits of each All-Star from that game, and it's kind of just fun, and we'll have, you know, the game playing in the background and whatnot, so it's just kind of cool to have it all come together like that.
I think that people are really going to love this show. Mm-hmm. Like, we can really relate to it. It's a small admission.
Yep. $2 admission, free for students and children and our South Shore Arts members.
And it's up through the end of January, towards the end of January. Okay, well, thanks, Bridget, for coming here to tell us about the show. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, or you can hear it again later today on All Things Considered. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.